From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to week two of Rock Month here at the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm Hunter Deucing, and joining me is glam legend Mr. John Grace out in the Rocky Mountain Hive, Colorado. Say hello, John.
Hello, all diamond dogs.
Yeah, he's a rebel, let me tell you. And in the wild outback of Australia, he's hotter than hell. He's a hero with a Robert Fripp solo. He's Mr. Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
1 minute. Sorry, just put my spandex on. Hello.
It's extra tight.
Yeah. Just showing off the old Australian cucumber there. That's all. Make sure I do that before I go on stage.
That's one of the... It's one of those things where you want to, when people see you, you want them to wonder, how did he get into that?
Yeah.
Like they did with Bowie.
Unfortunately, I saw that with Jim Dandy. He had to be at least 65 years old.
Oh my gosh.
Still not really in the wonderful condition that he probably was in 1973.
People in Memphis would tell me, they'd say, you know, I saw Jim Dandy in the 70s, and he was wearing the tight pants, and he's got the beautiful girls on each arm. Then I see him a decade later. Girls are less beautiful.
And the teeth are not as prominent in the mouth. There's a few missing every year.
They just said it was a slow slide.
Yeah, he has like the sodium packed neck rolls, too.
Mm-hmm. No, really.
Like you can't tell where the cheeks go right down to the what do you call it, the clavicle bone, the collarbone or whatever. It's just like his head is like this weird thing that looks like something out of From Beyond or a horror film like that.
When I first saw a picture of Jim Dandy, it was a current picture of Jim Dandy at the time.
Oh.
And if you had told me that guy was the big influence on David Lee Roth, I would have said, come again.
Yeah. And luckily, my first visual was like early 70s film footage of him in London. And so it's like, okay, I totally get the David Lee Roth thing. Like, it's
bloody. Yeah. Once you watch Bruce Lee,
it's that.
Like, so. Oh, you had to shoehorn one in, didn't you? You just couldn't help yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was trying to think of the most obvious thing professionally in the arts, and yeah, that's what you can come up with.
Exactly. Yeah, when you watch the Jim Dandy footage, you go, oh, okay, I see now. I get it. If you're at all familiar with David Lee Roth's repertoire.
Yeah.
But so, John, your pick for this year's Rock Month is a band I had never heard of. Called Silverhead. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed your picks are often sort of proto, sort of trashy glam bands.
Yeah.
You've talked to me. We've kind of had conversations where you say that that's kind of the stuff you sort of gravitate towards. What, expand on that a little bit.
I think the thing is, when you listen to a lot of what we now call proto metal, proto punk, or whatever, and it always tends to go back to this sort of lost period of 1972 to about 74, when bands like Slade and T-Rex were selling great in England, not selling so well in America. For whatever reason, America didn't go for that glitter scene at all. I guess you would say it was because of homophobia or whatever. That word, I don't think, existed back then. But
well, you had to be a comic book team like Kiss or something. Right.
It's like, I think Kiss intentionally chose costumes that made them look like Marvel superheroes. They didn't look like women, like the New York Dolls, or there wasn't anything real feminine about their appearance.
There wasn't like weird androgyny like with Bowie.
Right. It's like nothing to make people nervous about. And what I've always heard about Bowie, and I don't know if it's really true, is like his live shows sold very well in America, but his records didn't sell in America. So I don't know how true that all is. But this would be during the glam rock period. But they said like his live shows, he drew big crowds at the live shows, but just didn't sell records very much until probably Young Americans or something like that. It's a fascinating period to me because I think a lot of this music, when I listen to it, I'm like, okay, you listen to a Bowie song like Hang On to Yourself, and that's the Ramones. That's their entire discography, that guitar riff. And if you listen to The Clash, friends will tell me, everything The Clash did riff-wise was just the Suite. It's the Suite's music completely sped up and played faster. And maybe it's true. I have never done a comparison to see if that is true, but I believe him, you know, because he can play guitar. So he told me, oh, yeah, they just sped up a bunch of Suite riffs. So those bands, I think, are so fantastic, but they were ignored by classic rock radio for the most part, except for Bowie. But T-Rex, you might hear Bang a Gong. You might hear a New York Doll song.
Jeepster.
Yeah, you might hear Jeepster. You might hear a New York Doll song, but you're mostly going to hear Getting the Lead Out, and you might hear Deep Purple. You used to hear more of that back in the 80s. Nowadays, you're just going to get your Skinnerd and your Zap.
Deep Purple never really caught on in the U.S. They've got the cult fan base, but I don't know. Like, when I hear people wax poetic about classic rock, you know they're a normie if they don't know Deep Purple. You kind of
go
for the radio. If you're a real fan, if you know Deep Purple, you know, even if you don't have like a deep knowledge, because Deep Purple has so many different incarnations and permutations that a lot of people like, you know, only listen to a handful of their records. But if you talk to somebody, they love Zeppelin, but they've never heard of Deep Purple. You go, okay, well, you just listen to the radio. But yeah, I don't know, with the glam stuff, I've kind of noticed with some of it, it's been a while since I've paid attention to rock journalism, quote unquote, let's be real, Rolling Stone is just, you know, boomer culture being force fed to the young. You know?
They're fucking worse. They really are.
It's terrible. It's just like, hey, here's another all Bruce Springsteen issue.
Yeah, Springsteen, great songwriter. You know,
yeah,
that's like,
it speaks to the working man. Hey, by the way, here's an article by Matt Taibbi. I should be really mad about politics right now, guys.
Yeah, man, because Springsteen's all about the politics, and that's all anybody listens to.
He fights for the working man.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, Springsteen, yeah. Went down with the unions, though he never had a real job. Yeah, new Bob Dylan, you know, which is exactly what he's promoted as when he started out, was basically a Dylan clone.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Except Bob Dylan actually did come from the heart of America, and at least you could say his lyrics reflect, I think, the thinking man of middle America. And Springsteen is just, you know, that girl, that car.
Bob's kind of like Bowie in that he's had a lot of phases and a lot of he's morphed himself a lot. You know, when he was young, he was sort of the, hey, we got to talk about the working man, you know, and we got to talk about civil rights there, bud. And but you know, he had his evangelical Christian phase. He had his electric phase when he went electric. Oh my.
He's had a phase nobody wants to talk about, which is his Barry Goldwater conservative cowboy phase.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And him saying, oh, I just put the John Birch Society in the song because I thought it rhymed and it sounded good. I didn't have anything against him. it's like brilliant. That's just, it's a great way to, I mean, the way he makes fun of things like global warming when he's interviewed by Jan Winter, it's just, because Jan Winter's just there to lick his balls.
Jan Winter is King Boomer, you know.
It's the worst.
That guy is the boomer generation crystallized. He's the swamp thing of boomers.
I hope Me Too takes him down and he actually has real charges on him.
Yeah.
He goes down just like as bad as Weinstein. I hope it's all true.
That would be awesome. But
yeah.
But you know, but okay, but kind of going back to, you know, when I said about rock journalism, you know, I've seen the New York Dolls have sort of gotten the cult status, right? You know, in the sort of punk scene. But, you know, there's a lot of those sort of glammy bands that never took off that I've never heard about. And this is one of them, Silverhead.
There's a ton of them. It's remarkable to me every time. It seems like every year I discover yet another band that, you know, did two albums. Nobody paid attention to them.
Yeah.
Rolling Stone gave one bad review and, you know, that was the end.
Right. And apparently the Rolling Stone review was something that could make or break you at some point. I mean, I know Rolling Stone tried like crazy to sort of kill 80s metal and to no avail, but
they hated metal. Cream magazine may have also had some issues with some of these bands, but they were friendlier to that type of music.
Yeah, what was it? I always think of the scene in Almost Famous where Philip Seymour Hoffman is playing Lester Bangs.
Yeah.
He's going, I'd rather listen to the Guess Who than Jethro Tull. They say in 3 minutes what this fatuous nonsense can't say in an entire record.
Exactly.
You know, so.
Precisely. Yeah.
I kind of think about that. I'm a big prog fan, though. So, you know.
Right.
You know, I like Jethro Tull. Some of it. Not all of it. But
some is not much, Hunter.
Oh, of course. Of course.
They have a fucking flute, Hunter.
Listen, they taught Tony Iommi how to make a band. So
that's true.
If it wasn't for Tull, there would be no Black Sabbath.
That's true. Very true.
Also, you know, Thick as a Brick is kind of making fun of prog music because everybody was going, oh, Tull's a prog band after Aqualung. I'm going to do something really silly now.
how is that album Broadsword and the Beast? Is that what their album
was
from the Grammy and pissed everybody
off? I don't think it was Broadsword and the Beast. I think it was, what was that album called? Crest of the Knave, I think was it. I think it was Crest of the Knave.
Oh, God, I just hate the title already. That's such unfair garbage. Oh, man, okay. You know. As Mike Malloy said.
There's a guy, if you want a guy who can't sing anymore, Ian Anderson, that guy's voice is totally gone.
He never could sing.
Yeah, I mean, how could you tell? He talked his way through songs like Lou Reed. He had an English accent, you thought he was singing.
Well... I saw him doing Thick as a Brick live in like Iceland or something, and there was a guy who had to sing the higher pitched parts of Thick as a Brick, and there was yet another singer there.
Why can't these bands just realize that time is up?
Payouts are too good.
I think it's a lot of them, their income depends on touring, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like think, shit. You know, why would you bother? You're just tainting whatever sort of legacy you had.
I really think they should, if they need money, they should branch out into other fields. Like maybe get into production or just get into something else, songwriting. Like the band we're going to talk to tonight, the lead singer later found way more success in other endeavors.
Right. Yeah. When I noticed who the singer was, I was like, oh, huh.
That guy.
Hey,
yeah.
I know him.
Yeah.
So I guess
speaking
let's get
of almost
into
famous,
it.
Yeah, is a connection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Wow, what a tie-in! I didn't even think about that.
So there you go. Yeah, this band actually has a pretty explicit—not explicit, but a pretty interesting connection to Almost Famous. Silverhead, British band, fronted by Michael DeBar.
Yeah.
Who you may know as the ex-husband of Pamela DeBar.
Yeah.
who is the girl who wrote I'm With the Band. She's the famous, probably the world's most famous groupie. Mm-hmm. But Michael DeBar, if for those who don't know, he was Murdoch on MacGyver.
Yeah.
And he was also
a villain who could not die, as I discovered.
Yeah, so I mean, he was a successful actor, you know, and
very successful.
But he was in a few bands like Power Station.
Yeah, he was in Detective, and Detective played the punk band, although they were called something else, Hoodlum Rock on WKRP in Cincinnati. They were the infamous punk rock episode, and he's known actually probably best for that.
Interesting. He was also in the Sidney Poitier film To Sir with Love.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the Clint Eastwood classic Pink Cadillac.
Yeah.
He was also in the David Lynch masterpiece Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at his filmography, it's nothing to sneeze at.
He also was in Ghoulies. Hey, Ghoulies, yes. Directed by Charles Band. Good stuff.
I remember being tripped out when I saw Ghoulies. I said, hey, that's the guy that took over the Power Station for Robert Palmer. Because, you know, back then, I didn't know his history. You couldn't find out some performer's history as easy as you could today. You actually had to depend on the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Encyclopedia to figure out who these people were, or articles and magazines.
Yeah, you had to look it up.
We didn't have Eddie Trunk to give us the knowledge.
He gives us the lowdown.
The rock and roll Talmud of his show.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's what we'll call Eddie Trunk from now on, the rock and roll rabbi. So Silverhead did two albums, Silverhead in 1972 and 16 and Savaged in 1973. Mm-hmm. Their lineup was you had Michael DeBar on vocals, Rod Davies on guitar, Nigel Harrison on bass, Pete Thompson on drums, and on the first record, there was a guy named Stevie Forrest on guitar, and on the 16 and Savaged, you had Robbie Blunt.
Yeah.
So the first album, Silverhead, 1972, the tracks, we've got Long Legged Lisa, Underneath the Light, Ace Supreme, Johnny In Your Eyes, not to be confused with the Peter Gabriel track, Rolling With My Baby, Wounded Heart, Sold Me Down the River, Rock and Roll Band, not to be confused with, who sings that song? I don't know, whatever. Silver Boogie is the last song. So, John, how'd you come across this stuff? Was this the first one you listened to?
What happened was I used to subscribe to Jeff Dahl's fanzine, Sonic Iguana. And, I think he did a review of the Repertoire release of the first Silverhead album and talked about how great these guys were and how they seemed to have it all, but they didn't click. With record sales or whatever. And also they were brought up in an interview where some band, I think it was the Beat Angels, they said that they saw Michael DeBar at a Hollywood club with Patricia Arquette. He was dating her. And he went over to Michael and said, you know, Silverhead is like one of the great underrated bands of the 70s. And I guess Michael DeBar's face lit up and went, tell her that! Tell her that! and then he goes, I guess he was losing her or something. And he was trying to save some face. But
she had her eye on one of the guys from Toto because Rosanna. Right.
Or something, you know, at least you can at least say Patricia hung out with cooler, you know, was getting with cooler musicians than Patricia. Yeah. Than Rosanna. The thing was, I found the Silverhead CD, the Repertoire release at a used CD store when I moved out to Colorado. It wasn't easy to find. You didn't see it anywhere. And Amazon wasn't quite the mail order next day juggernaut that it is today. And so you still had to hunt for your CDs. And order from Deep Discount, and it might take a month or two to get them, you know, because they had to order them from England. So I checked it out, and I thought it was pretty good. And kind of, you know, put the album on MP3. Wasn't really a real special release. Didn't sound exceptional. It sounded decent, but I kind of got the gist. And I thought that was their only album. and just traded it in, and you know, went, listed other bands, but always remembered Silverhead as being this good band from that scene that nobody listened to. So then recently I was on Twitter and came across a tweet from Michael DeBar, and I had no idea he's a DJ on Little Steven's Underground Garage. That's his job.
Oh, wow. Like,
he put out a new album recently with like a Dylan cover. Oh, coincidence. And I just gave him a heads up and said, oh, man, the lead singer of Silverhead is on Twitter. And he gave me a
There's your Bruce Springsteen connection. He's on Little Stevie's.
What a small world. Yeah. Know who they signed with in the early 70s. Silverhead was on Purple Records, the Deep Purple record label. So,
Gosh.
Yep. And
it's like together. The Viewers' Universe, man. It just all ties in.
Yeah, it is. Throw a bottle of Yoo-Hoo at a production assistant.
I think what we need is the Avengers Infinity War of this episode. You know,
where early 70s rock music scene, you have your Infinity War completely.
Well, and what we'll do is, like, Michael DeBar will get the Infinity Gauntlet, and he'll, you know, destroy all the music that's, like, not as good, you know, and they'll be like, Mr. DeBar, I don't feel so good.
But so a couple of months ago, I noticed that there were two Silverhead albums, and there was also a live album, and I just ordered them on an Amazon deal, and they'd been released with loads of bonus tracks and remastering, and I was like, okay, I can go for this. And ordered them, listened to them. I'm like, what a great underrated band, and very ahead of their time, at least by a year or two, because the Sweet were still doing Bubblegum Records when these guys put out the first album.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Bolan was kind of getting there, is what they said on All Music. They said, you know, they were kind of just there first. And this also tied in with the fact that lately I've been listening to a lot of Mott the Hoople and the early Bowie and some more obscure stuff, some Slade. I've been listening to a lot of Slade lately, and my son's favorite band is now Mott the Hoople. I blame myself entirely. And so listening to this fit right in with the rock music I'm listening to, and see where I'll be.
So did you say, Cato, you're a young dude, I need you to carry the news?
Yeah, apparently. Well, the thing about raising kids today, they don't, if they have parents that listen to a lot of music and a deep record collection, they don't have to do like I did and really search on that dial for something listenable.
Oh, yeah, where you hear a song. I remember this guy I teach with, we went to go see Marillion live, and Marillion's a pretty obscure band, especially here in the United States. And he said he was listening on the radio on a tractor, and he heard the song He Knows You Know, and he went, oh, that's really interesting. But he was working on a tractor wearing like headphones, listening to a radio in the 80s. And he said he was like scanning around trying to find that song so he could find out who sang it, you know, because he couldn't really hear it. And so it was kind of work just to find out, okay, who sang that song? You know, like
there are several tunes I'm still doing that with that I heard on MTV or the radio, and I cannot remember what the real credits were and what the title of the song was. And I'm hoping I'll come across them.
It's like for years I thought America's Horse with No Name was by Neil Young.
Everybody thinks that. Everybody gets corrected on that sooner or later in their life.
Oh, man. For the longest time, I thought that was a Neil Young song.
I had to correct my boomer uncle on that. I said, that's America. That's not Neil Young. I said, I thought it too, and then I was corrected by my cousin. So I was like, okay.
That was the biggest boomer post I've ever done. That's it.
And it's basically just a dead-on clone song of Neil Young. It's completely sound like him.
Yeah, it sounded like they were biting his style, you know?
Completely.
And nobody imitated 80s Neil Young, though.
No, not at all. I think maybe he wanted it to where bands like America could not imitate him. And so he did these weird, off-putting albums.
Oh, man. That's one way of describing it. But yeah, Stuart, what were some of your impressions on Silverhead's first record? What did you think?
Well, kind of knew what to expect looking at the front cover. But, I thought it was a good album all up. Not a great one. One of the problems I had was maybe one slow song too many for my liking on there. But, pretty damn good overall. Sound-wise, it was... I tried to sit there and I really shouldn't have. I tried to pigeonhole them saying, right, they sound like Bowie exclusively, but they don't. They sound like a bit like Bowie. I picked up, and correct me if I'm wrong, traces of Fog Hat in there.
There were some songs on these albums that I thought had kind of a strong country influence. Not directly. Like, I wouldn't go, oh, this is a country band if I listened to it, but there were some of the slower songs. I mean, I think this first album does maybe have one slow song too many.
Yeah.
But I think some of the slower songs do have kind of a country spirit in that they kind of feel like down on your luck bar songs.
Yeah, and he claims his big influence was, of course, blues records from America.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't think about the race of the singer, if you listen to, you could listen to a mixture of blues and country, and you could see the structural similarities.
Absolutely. You know. I mean, you know, a lot of people like to give blues soul credit for rock and roll, but country deserves equal, I think, distinction.
It does, and I think blues came from a lot of Irish folk music.
Oh, yeah.
I don't believe in this. It was some African music style, or it was completely from gospel. I think a lot of it came from Irish folk tunes.
Oh yeah, no,
Celtic or whatever you want to call it. Whatever that you could trace that back to. I think that's where it really came from.
Right. It's kind of like ranchero music comes from polka.
Yes, exactly.
So.
Yeah, and the amount of slow songs is probably why I traded it in 8 years ago, you know, made an MP3 rip and then traded it in thinking, oh, I'm not going to care about these guys again, or I just like the rockin' tunes, or the slow songs do it for me every now and then. You know, it's just because I was listening to mostly rock music at that time and spending some time away from it. And then when I got the remastered version, I dug it a bit more, you know.
Yeah. No, yeah, I agree with Stuart that it has a few too many slow songs. Some of the songs go on a bit longer than I would like.
Mm. Yeah, and boy, that was that period back then. Is like, if you listen to like a Faces album or like Jeff Beck Group or something, sometimes the tunes just go on too long, you know, because they have to have a piano.
Considering we just did Mac Lads last week, and basically every song was like two and a half minutes. I'm like,
yeah,
oh, look at the time. You're like, wow, this one runs 6 minutes. Shit.
Okay. Well, you guys are going to hate me next episode, but.
Oh, no.
Are you progging us on the next episode?
I'm progging you guys pretty hard.
You knew it was coming. With Stu, we're going to get the real working class stuff.
The short, 1-2 minutes.
with me, you're going to get the sleazy glam rock, and then with Hunter, you're going to get the prog. We're going to get progged out.
You get the prog weird stuff. You know, I'm kind of giving.
That's kind of our rock month. And then everybody.
I always pick like the King's X's and the Faith No Mores and stuff like that.
The collective pick will be what we call the Eddie Trunk pick. So it'll
Pretty much. Let's pacify the audience pick is what it is. It's
exactly.
Let's not turn them away completely pick.
Yeah, exactly. But I think this is definitely an album. If you enjoy sort of 70s rock, you like some piano in there. You like some kind of, I think it has like a barroom appeal, you know, that, and it's got a really raw sound that I like. It has, it's got a barroom appeal, but it also kind of has like kind of that punk production quality.
Right, it's a Faces. I think of it as a Faces Stones vibe. You know, you could see Ron Wood being in this band, the young Ron.
Oh,
Wood.
Absolutely.
not that corpse called Ron Wood. That's you know,
to me,
up with Jagger.
This band or this album sounds like a band just trying to find a sound.
Yeah.
Whereas the second album, they found their sound.
Yeah. So let's get on to that. So, what would you give?
No, wait. Well, I just do want to say that this album does come with a bunch of bonus tracks. There was one on there I thought, my God, why did you leave it off the album? Which was the, No. I'm like, why did you leave that off? This is probably the best track on the whole album. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just odd.
Yeah, no, there was also another version. I can't remember if it was a 7-inch version of one of the songs that I thought actually sounded way stronger.
Ace Supreme, yeah. It did sound
better. Yeah. That sounded way better than the album version. And that was, I don't think that was on the repertoire release from years ago. And I mean, this is the one to get. If you get the new versions that are out, that are on Amazon. just that are the remasters.
Just going back to the suite there, you said about the version of Ace Supreme sounding different and better to what the LP one does, which I agree with you. Mm-hmm. That tended to be a thing back then as well, somewhat, because the suite did it a number of times. They definitely did it with Fox on the Run. If you listen to Fox on the Run, the 7-inch version, it's the one that everybody knows. If you listen to the one on the Desolation Boulevard, it's very different.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So,
so John, what would you give Silverhead's first inaugural self-titled album?
I give it like a 7.5.
Okay.
Leaning towards an 8. I'm gonna listen to it. The slow songs do. There, it's too many slow songs, and I was really surprised when I finally heard it that it had so many slow songs on it. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with them. It's like they were trying.
They're not bad songs.
Yeah, and
they're not bad songs at all. It's just kind of, you kind of go, oh, another slow one. You
could have pulled one out. You could have pulled one of them out and used it as the B side of Ace Supreme and put Oh No No in there instead, just to, you know, lift the tempo a bit of the album.
And I will say that something like Rolling With My Baby, you listen to that, and to me, that's almost like probably inspired AC/DC, the Bon Scott years, you know. It's just like it has that type of drive to it.
Oh, I bet there was bands out there that did take inspiration from Silverhead, but they're just not going to say because people are going to go, who the hell is that? Never heard of them.
Right. And only, you know, other kind of obscure glam artists will tell you Silverhead was a big inspiration. And, of course, you know, a lot of the bigger groups that are going to tell you, oh, yeah, we listened to Silverhead and they were underrated.
Yeah.
Because you could see where bands, like even up to 80s glam rock, like they could steal from these guys.
Oh, definitely.
And Michael DeParr was part of that Rainbow Bar and Grill scene or the Sunset Strip. You know?
Oh, without a doubt. I'm sure someone like Nikki Sixx, who was a big music aficionado in his, you know, early years, would have, you know, picked something off of Silverhead and as much as he did with Aerosmith.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think there's an influence out there. I'll give it a 6.5 to 7. I'm teetering on in between there.
I give it a solid 7. I think, you know, even though, like, I think the slow songs criticism is not a criticism of those songs. It's more of a criticism of the flow of the record.
Yeah, album balance. You know, that's an important thing nobody thinks about these days. Yeah,
well, that's what Van Halen was going to call balance. It's going to be called album balance. And it
band that was good about balance, and it was in the David Lee Roth era with, you know, because he said they could only be 30 minutes long, and they were designed, you know, they only fucked up on Diver Down, really.
Yeah, and they were going to call it album balance, and it was just going to be Sammy Hagar waxing poetic about, you know, proper album flow.
Yeah, you can drive a minivan to the record and drink some milk. Wow!
All right, so the next year, and that was 1972. Next year, 1973, we got the second and final Silverhead release, 16 and Savaged. And the track listing on this one, we've got Hello New York, More Than Your Mouth Can Hold, Only You, Bright Light, Heavy Hammer, Cartoon Princess, Rock Out Claudette, Rock Out, This Ain't a Parody, 16 and Savaged, James Dean, and Marilyn. And the remaster has some live and other singles on there.
Yeah.
So, John, you heard this one later?
Yeah, I only heard it like last month when the order came in.
Well, you were probably in for a surprise then.
Boy, I got knocked out of my shoes basically when I put this sucker in.
Yeah, because
I was like, whoa.
I think personally, I think this is the superior of the two.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate for rock music that they broke up after this.
Yeah, because it really felt like all the sounds I heard on the first one were sort of consolidated into a more slick package here. And I don't mean slick in a production / mainstream sense. I just mean in like they found everything that worked and, you know, sort of focused on that, making a tighter record.
And it rocks. It's just like, it's right. By the way, actually, according to the listing on the remastered thing, James Dean and Marilyn were not part of the original album. It stopped at 16 and Savaged.
Oh, so, really?
Imagine when you listen to this and you just listen to those songs, what this would have sounded like back then, and then wonder, you know, where were all the goons buying, like, B the Blue Oyster Cult and New York Dolls, you know, what few there were, and Dictators and all that stuff. It's like they should have been grabbing this too, you know.
I think music
would have been better off if these guys had cut another album. They supposedly broke up recording a third album, and they just couldn't handle it anymore.
That's kind of how it went back then. You know, with the way the industry works today, you can be sort of a modestly successful band, and you know, you're touring constantly, but you can live. Whereas back then, it was kind of like if you didn't have success, it was, what are you doing? You know,
right?
Like go form another group. Like, you know, that was what killed the Dictators.
Yeah,
was they put out an album, nobody cared. They put out another album, no one cared. Mm-hmm. Put out a third album, no one cared. And so they were like, all right, nobody cares, you know. And then they got kind of a cult following and did some stuff later. But I also think Andy Chernoff probably just didn't want to, I don't know. Probably
yeah, I don't think he had the work ethic to really keep going.
He'd rather hang out at home and watch TV, you know.
Right, right. And figure out ways to hit on young girls, you know, with fans exactly. at his shows. Exactly.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's that sort of thing where it's like these guys seem to have it all. They had the package. There's very little footage of them performing. There's like one clip from Japanese TV, I believe, that you can find on YouTube of them perform "Rolling with My Baby," and you see they had the package. They had the look. It's like why they weren't big is just an industry that probably. Like I said, you know, all those bands I like, like this Sweet, it took them a long time before they were big in America, and they were only big for a brief time, and T-Rex was never really huge here. Slade, ignored.
T-Rex got killed pretty young, so, you know, it's
Right. Gary Glitter, probably a good thing he didn't make it over here, but the music was...
Isn't that guy in prison now?
Yes, I believe he is serving for whatever his third rape or something like that. But the thing about Gary Glitter is I love that music, but God, what an awful human being. I wouldn't care if he was shot between the eyes, you know. It's just like, but my God, I love those songs. I hate that I love them, but, you know, it's like, I know how a Michael Jackson fan feels, you know.
Yeah, or somebody who enjoys the movie Chinatown or something.
Right. I'm like, oh God, I love Polanski movies and I love Gary Glitter, but I hope they get movies. Killed. Yeah.
I really would rather Roman Polanski be in prison than be making all those movies, but you know, they're not so bad.
Right, precisely. And you know, everything Harvey Weinstein produced, I have on my shelf, but you know.
I've still got all those Dragon Dynasty releases with Baylor and comics.
And I think maybe it was something about the image. If these guys, let's say they appeared on Don Kirshner's rock concert and they had the androgynous look and everything, maybe it just turn potential rock fans off. They couldn't deal with the kind of fey glitter look. You know, I think that's what hurt the Darkness in this country.
I remember, like, you look at the first footage of the Ramones performing, mm-hmm. and Joey Ramone's doing these like little twists, and he's doing these little glam rock moves.
Yeah, he's doing like a limp wrist sort of thing, and it's just like, well, that couldn't have gone over well.
Well, Johnny in his book, Johnny Ramone said that Joey was doing this gay rock stuff at the first show. So I grabbed him. I said, "Not none of that stuff. We're not doing that. Just stand there, hold the mic, and sing." You know, and that's why you know you see in the Ramones footage after that, Joey is just standing there holding the mic and singing. Or yeah. yelling, or whatever you know you want to call it, but he, you know, you watch that first stuff. He's doing all these glam rock moves, and apparently Johnny Ramone pulled him aside and said, "Knock it off," you know.
Right. And it's just like I think there could be a very negative reaction back then because supposedly it was like a big deal when, I guess when the Stones performed on SNL, I guess Mick kissed Keith or some nonsense like that. And that was the talk of the town. Like, if you were in small town America, they couldn't deal with that. Like, no one understood that whole British tongue.
If you were in small town America, you could not handle the David Bowie, Mick Jagger dancing in the street video.
Oh, yeah. That's when you started hearing about all those urban legends.
Fags doing there on that television.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you got. And
turn that shit off and put some Archie Bunker on.
Turn on All the Family there. Sweetie.
Put on Bonanza. I don't want to see this crap, you know. So. Trying to turn my son into a sissy, you know. So.
Put on that Gomer Pyle. Put on that real man Jim Neighbors now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Gomer Pyle, that's a good show.
Hey, here's Jim Neighbors singing "To Dream the Impossible Dream." Now there's a man.
Oh, look, a Rock Hudson Western Zone. Yeah, there we go.
All that heaven allows, Rock Hudson. Now there's a man.
But
what about that movie with Rock Hudson and Pillow Talk? It's actually called Bite the Pillow Talk.
Well, and that's the thing that a lot of that crowd, you know, the Budweiser crowd didn't get, was basically that fae thing attracted teenage girls. Teenage girls really like that. And
they vote, you know, when you look at what teenage girls like, it's always the guy looks like a chick, you know, like like Twilight. Remember how big Twilight was?
Right.
And any guy who looked at Edward and Jacob went, what are you guys, what's wrong with y'all? Like, what's going on?
What is this, Blue Boy Magazine? What the hell?
It's like the women of the 60s weren't really smart. They were chasing Rock Hudson and Tab Hunter and, well, you know. Wake up, girls, really.
It's all screwy with those instincts, you know.
Yeah. So it's just like that's just misunderstood. Even though if they had heard the music without seeing the band at all, they would have loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's what hurt the darkness. What got the darkness temporarily big in America? The video played on MTV. What's the problem with the video? Not everybody gets that it's a joke.
Well, and Justin Hawkins' outfits, you know?
Yeah, he totally overdid it. Like he looks like a parody. It's like a gay parody of Steve Tyler, you know.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and he's got the weird like tattoos with the text on. You know, I don't know.
Oh, he's actually wearing outfits that Silverhead, you know, probably could have worn that day.
Oh yeah, totally.
Back then.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I'm surprised. I'd be surprised if he wasn't influenced by him or had at least listened to him.
Right.
Him
I mean,
and his brother way
like,
into that stuff.
Well, the cover of the second album, 16 and Savage, is Michael DeBar looking like a chick. He's completely glammed up, and it's hard to tell.
Yeah, like I thought that was just some model.
No, that's him, and that's
when I saw it originally.
That's really not a way to sell your band in America. So,
when like writing in lipstick on the window, you know.
Yeah. Are you sure that's him? Because he's got tits. This thing on the front of the cover.
I have read that's him. I don't know how. I don't know if he built it up. I thought it was a model too. Supposedly, it's him on the cover. Yeah, I don't think it is though. I think that's probably a misprint somewhere on the text for it or something. Because
yeah,
I had read a review claiming that was him on the cover. It's like, look at it. I'm not so sure. No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, he can.
No,
do
it looks
a,
nothing
he can
like him. Come on, man. Look at the picture on the front compared to the one on the back.
Yeah, you look
on
the back.
Him.
He's pretty ripped. So yeah, you know, it's not. Yeah. I don't buy it. Yeah, I don't think it's him. So, yeah. So whoever this model is, it's like I don't think the model could sell it though.
It's probably Pamela's groupie girls.
Oh, probably yeah. It's probably a GTO member or something.
Yeah,
something like that. But you know, but you look at Foreigner's album cover for Head Games. It's not the most attractive cover either, and that thing sold like crazy.
Or most of UFO album covers are shit.
Oh yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah, that all the UFO album covers were done by the people who did the Pink Floyd stuff, Hypnosis.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Storm Thorgerson. Yeah.
Hey, it helped Eddie Trunk.
Hey, yeah. Hey, they were my favorite band, UFO. Michael Schenker, if there's one band I could see live today, that'd be the Strangers in the Night lineup of UFO.
Well, the thing with Michael DeBar is, like, I mean, the image on the first album and with the PR photos I've seen in the videos, he almost looks like the inspiration for James O'Barr's The Crow comic book.
Yeah, he does. So
He was definitely doing that scrawny thing, and James O'Barr always says it was Iggy Pop that inspired the look, but man, if he doesn't look more like Michael DeBar, you know, it's like definitely more there.
Okay, just got a question for you. How long was he married to Pamela for?
Just a few years, I think.
Oh, okay.
Can't imagine that's a relationship that would have lasted very long. She kept his name, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, she did. Well, apparently, there's a lot about him in her books.
Oh, wait, they were married from 77 to 91.
I don't know if they were still together.
I don't know if they were like, you know, officially
on paper married from then. But
we'll find out a little later. I'll reveal why that was probably held up in court a long time. So because Michael DeBar had an amazing success that most people don't know about that I think made him millions, and he only mentions every now and then. So we'll talk about it after we rate the record.
There's only so far Pamela's the size of a pelican's beak vagina can get you before you start going broke.
Well, so let's go ahead and rate 16 and Savaged. I'm going to give it an 8. I think it's a solid, very solid record. That I think it's if you want to check out a Silverhead record, this is the one to start with.
Yeah, I give it a 7.5 for sure.
John?
Yeah, I give it an 8.5. I think it rocks. It's yep. Spectacular. It's like I think this would might be the one to start with if
yeah, somebody wanted to give it a think, try. I actually listened to this one before I listened to the other one, and I was like, oh, man.
Yeah, listen to this first. Get the second one after if you like this one, just to have and you've got a complete studio discography. There's a live album afterwards I've not listened to yet that it's not well-regarded, but I think hardcore fans love it. And I should say this band was huge in Japan, of course, because they're always huge in Japan. And they've actually done reunion shows in Japan. And a few years ago, they apparently did a reunion gig that was released as a DVD in that country.
Mm.
So, because, hey, Japan, they're hardcore.
They love all the music that America doesn't.
Right. And then, after 16 and Savage, and the band broke up in the middle of recording their third album. I don't know if those tracks have ever been released anywhere, or if they've been preserved. They broke up. He formed a group called Detective that I'm told is basically a Led Zeppelin sound-alike. And they yet oddly signed to Swan Song. So they were a Swan Song group. And he appeared on WKRP in Cincinnati and started having regular acting gigs and horror movies and such. But he also wrote a song, I believe, for maybe his solo record. He did a duet with, he did have a solo career, a song called Obsession. And it didn't go anywhere, his duet with Holly Knight. But a year later, Animotion recorded Obsession and had a monster hit worldwide.
Really?
One of the most popular songs of the 80s as far as your one-hit wonders go. That is Michael DeBar did the first version, wrote it, and got... He actually said he made millions in royalties off that song. I don't know how true that is. I don't know if he's exaggerating. I would have no problem believing it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Because if you think about how that song is used so often in movie soundtracks and how you couldn't get away from it in 1985, it must have done huge. And also, he is notorious, and this was my introduction to him, when the Power Station played Live Aid, Robert Palmer didn't want to perform with them anymore and wanted to go back to his solo career, so Michael DeBar took over And I said, who's this British guy singing for the Power in place of Robert Palmer? And so that's where I first saw him. And he did perform with the Power Station for a while. He was their singer. They did a song on the Commando soundtrack called Somewhere, Somehow. And it plays over the closing credits. If you watch Commando, you'll hear this tune. It's the Power Station with Michael DeBar. But it was apparently... Obsession just made all his money, and now he is, after all his acting career, he is a he's a DJ for Little Steven, Sirius Satellite Radio. I have never heard it because I canceled Sirius years ago, but I did consider maybe getting it for his show, but
I have Sirius, so I'll have to check it out.
Supposedly it's really good. Like, it's a really fun show to listen to, and he seems like he'd be just right for that. So
that was like the one I used to listen to on Fridays here was Nights with Alice Cooper. They used to have a lot of fun listening.
And that was sort of a cash-in on Little Steven's Underground Garage show that was in syndication in a lot of markets it played on the weekends. And I noticed a couple of years after that was doing really well, Alice Cooper did the Nights with Alice Cooper. And it was kind of a similar concept with him playing older tracks and waxing nostalgic on the mic. And I liked Alice Cooper's show. I used to listen to it when I could.
Every Friday, without doubt.
Right. We had him every night. It's crazy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Anything else to add for Silverhead? I keep wanting to call them Silverfish, and I don't know why that is.
No, better that than Silver Chair, I guess.
And there's a problem. They'll probably get confused with Silverhead. I mean, Silver Chair or whatever. Yeah, so I remember when this guy...
Bloody Nirvana. And
like third. Yeah, they were like one of those third wave, like post-grunge bands, you know?
Yeah, and that's, like I said, I think this band, I think Silverhead is an inspiration on a lot of groups that won't admit to it. And, you know, I think if you find yourself wanting to listen to like the sleazy glam rock and you're real disappointed in the last Guns N' Roses record a decade ago, you know, may want to check out stuff that probably inspired them a great deal.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, I should also add Michael Tabar is one of the founders of Rock Against Drugs.
Yes, he
crashed and burned really bad in the 70s, and he admits it. So, you know, apparently, I guess he was swigging booze like a barbarian or something when he came over here. You know, being that young and having that metabolism, you just don't know how much that stuff's going to fuck you up. So,
yeah, and that was an era when people were pretty out of control with that stuff.
Yeah. It was, bad era. That's where they learned, you know. I still get questions from my kid. Why did Jimi Hendrix OD? And I said, I really think they all thought they were invincible back then.
Oh, yeah, and that a lot of people didn't know about cocaine and stuff like that. You know, right, they were like, just everybody did it, you know, in Hollywood, you know.
Yeah, Michael Tabor actually said that they would be on coke and they would be up for 10 days. Performing Jesus. And everything. Yeah, and he just said, maybe he's exaggerating a little. He may not be. You know, they didn't know.
10 days, that's insane.
Yeah, he just said it was insanity, you know.
That hurts to think.
Oh, yeah, I know. I just like, good Lord. I always feel blessed if I get like 8 hours of sleep. And it's like, geez.
I just got six before and I feel like shit. So.
But yeah, something else. It's like, he's one of the rad founders. And if you follow him on Twitter, he'll follow you back. So he's nice about that. But yeah, get ready for some very hippy dippy. You know, the world needs peace and love and understanding views. So, but he seems like a nice guy.
If you can survive Glenn Hughes on Twitter, you can survive Michael Tabor. Don't worry.
Exactly.
Emoji movie man.
but yeah. It's a good band to check out, and I always like to shine a spotlight on these kind of unappreciated groups. And almost was a big thing, or could have should have been. You know, it's either that or go back and listen to Ziggy Stardust and Desolation Boulevard for the 5,000th time. So,
yeah,
nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with new music to the ears. Never hurts. Exactly.
And it is a fascinating underappreciated era. Thanks, boomers. Thanks for fucking everything up. So I really appreciate it for making American rock music as sterile as possible over the decades. Thank you. And ignoring really good bands.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys. Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up. If there's nothing else to add, we'll be back next week. I'm going to take a little holiday, but I don't think that listeners will notice. But yeah, that doesn't mean I'll be gone from the show. But yeah, with that, next week we'll do week 3 and then our collective picks. So
you should try and get the Pope on the show to do your choice for next week.
The Pope. Yeah, I will. No, yeah,
he's a commie. He likes the dead Kennedys, I bet.
Exactly. Yeah.
And nuclear assault.
Like he's told me that Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables is his favorite punk album.
If not, maybe you'd want to do Weezer. I don't know.
We can listen to their new covers of Rosanna and Africa by Toto.
Yeah. No, thanks.
All right, guys. Well, next week it's my pick, and we'll just see what it is when it comes out. So it's going to be proggy.
There's a clue on this show if you listen to it.
Yeah. So. All right, guys. Well, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
Big corporations suck.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.